the next session, which is career success and failure in life. Because it's not just in your career, in your business, but it's also your career in your community, in your village, or even in your country, let alone a country in our world. Because remember, they started off as talking about a relationship with yourself, and then relationship in your family, especially in your marriage, now relationship with your world, with other people, which is also a relationship with other religions, with other races, with other ways of doing things. So we cannot just have a successful career in our business, we can also have a successful life. Because what use is a successful career if there's some sort of war and there's no peace to enjoy the fruits of your labors? So it's important to learn how to have relationships which actually transcend ourselves, which go off into our business, into our clients, our customers, and also further out into the world. And these Buddhist principles do apply in those areas as well. Sometimes that people misunderstand what I say about living simply and being content. Does that mean you're not allowed to be rich? Not allowed to be wealthy? Are all Buddhists supposed to be poor? If that was the case, it would be a waste of time me trying to raise funds for my retreat center. No, the point was, and the Buddha made this very clear, that wealth is fine as long as it's earned properly. In other words, according to Dhamma, not exploiting other people, but you know, earned because of your hard work, because of your skill, your ingenuity. And if it's earned in the right way, he said, marvelous, well done, it's a result of your good karma. You're meant to be wealthy, so well done. But use your wealth appropriately, the Buddha advised, for your own enjoyment, for your family, being invested for the future, and also for society, such as monasteries, such as hospitals. That is to split it four ways, the Buddha said. But that being said, that you know, to be successful in life, which all of us intend to be, it takes a lot of hard work, but also Buddhist principles can actually assist in having success in your company. As many of you would know, in a company, in any sort of business, you have to be very sharp, very alert, because sometimes there are possibilities, there are opportunities to make good business, and those people who succeed are the ones who are sharp enough to spot those opportunities early and are resourceful enough to take hold of those opportunities to exploit them and to make their wealth. One of my monks used to be a stockbroker, and he said as soon as people know about those rumors on the street, it's too late. As a stockbroker, you've got to be sharp enough, clever enough to see it before the ordinary person knows about it. And you can understand, to have that degree of sharpness in a business, you have to have a very mindful and alert consciousness, which is the first thing I wanted to emphasize here. In the same way that in a marriage you have to be sensitive to each other, in business you have to be sensitive to the markets, to your customers, to your suppliers. And that sensitivity is so important, especially sensitivity to markets, because too many businesses go under because they become lazy. They may have had a product which has worked last year and they think it's going to work again this year. They don't adapt, they don't change. And because they don't adapt to changing market needs, of course their business goes under. You always have to adapt. Even like myself as a monk, I always have to find new stories, new jokes. If I keep telling the same old stories and the same old jokes, you're not going to come again. I have to change my product every year to give a new launch. So it applies to say, and I have to be sensitive to my audience. Now you're talking about like sexuality. I have to see how far can I go with you? If I go too far, you get sort of upset. If I don't go far enough, say, what's the point? So that sensitivity is also important in my career, in my business, the monk business, not the monkey business, the monk business, as it is in your business as well. And I've seen that many, many times, that when a business is really sensitive to their client base, their customers, In other words, they're always keeping on listening to what the client needs, what the customers want. I remember reading about Dell Computers, and when the fellow who founded that, one of the reasons why he had a very good growth, he listened to his customers, and he actually adapted the computers, which he got, you know, very cheaply. He changed them to make them more friendly to his client base. And also to get, I think it was the first one, to get a 24-hour service, customer service, if anyone had any problems with using their computers. And because of his innovation, because he was sensitive, you know, he found out what his customers needed. Now, of course, that is now one of the biggest companies in the world. In the space of just 25 years, not that long. And you can see why that worked. Sensitivity. What in Buddhism we call mindfulness, alertness. So to be successful in your career, if you're in business, or say you're a doctor, or you're just like a bus driver, you've got to be sensitive to the traffic. You've got to be sensitive to the customers. You've got to be sensitive to your boss. Now there's a time to actually to stand up to your boss and say, no, look, I can't do that. But there's also a time to walk away and not to upset that boss. Otherwise you'll be out. So that sensitivity to the people employing you, but also the sensitivity to the people you're serving, will make you adapt to the time and place. One of my cousins who was a salesman, and he would always say that, you know, whenever you went to see a customer, sometimes you realized straight away it was the wrong time to try and sell your product. All you could do is say hello, goodbye, and get out as quick as you could. And because he developed that sensitivity, he became a very successful salesperson. There's other times he knew he could actually push the product and get a sale. Without that mindfulness, that sensitivity, you would never be able to do that. Also, in a company, as you would know, or say as a doctor, or anything else you do in your life, so much of today's work is done in a team, because the amount of knowledge and experience and expertise is too great for any one person. We have to learn how to work together. Which is why that book, Emotional Intelligence, showed that the people who made the best advances in research and development were not those people who were brilliant, who got the top marks at university, but those people who had made their contacts. If they had a problem, they knew who to email to get an answer straight away. And it was that networking ability which actually gave people Nobel Prizes and became successful in their careers. And to be able to network means you have to communicate with other people, you have to be sensitive, you have to form those relationships. That's why he called that book Emotional Intelligence, which is a very, I know it's been around a long time, but it's a very good book to read. It's very Buddhist. It's actually showing just for success in life, you have to have that ability to cooperate, to be sensitive, to learn from other people, and to work together in the same way you learn how to work together in a family, the same way you learn to work together with yourself, with your defilements, what I said in the first session, this is what you also do in a company. And there have been many case studies of successful companies whose success comes from their ethic of a community, their ethic of working together, of being a team, of not working against each other. One of the first times I heard about this was when one of my disciples migrated from Western Germany. This was before unification. He just wanted a better, sunnier lifestyle in Australia rather than in cold Northern Europe. And this was a time the West German economy was one of the strongest in the world. I think Japan and West Germany were even stronger than the US economy at this time. And when he went to work in some electronic field in Western Australia, he told me that his co-workers were just talking to him and saying the reason why the West German economy was so strong at that time was because the Germans worked so hard. He said, no, they don't. He said, I have to work much harder here in Australia. Then why is the West German economy so much better than the Australians, they remarked. And he said, because what I've seen so far in Australia, when we work in Australia, he said, you work like this, against each other. There's too much competition. But he said, in West Germany, when we work together in the same direction. There's more cooperation. And he said that was the reason why at that time the West German economy was so strong, because they had learned how to cooperate, to work together as a team with a common goal, rather than thinking how I can get past my person in the office, so I can get the promotion first. They have to have that sort of cooperation to have success in life. So it's not just being sensitive to the market, it's also like the cooperation, the learning how to work with people, to get those contacts, to get that friendship, to have that emotional intelligence, so you can have partnerships, if not actually partnerships in business, like your friends, your business contacts, and always be sharp and on the ball. So many businesses go under simply because of stupidity. They make silly mistakes. And if you are wise, you don't need to make those mistakes. Some of those silly mistakes is because, you know, we take it for granted, we think it's always going to be boom times, they overinvest. And obviously, you all know the stock market goes up and goes down. Still people say that there's no more busts in the stock market. Now it's always going to be booms. We have got all the controls in place. But that's what they said years and years and years and years ago as well. There'll always be some busts and some booms. Maybe not as much as before, but you know that what goes up goes down. There's anicca. So it makes sense that when there's good times, not to over-invest, but to keep a little bit back in reserve. It makes common sense. Unfortunately, that sometimes, because of greed, too much desire, we don't follow common sense. We get into fantasies. So in business, as in life, to be successful, you know, we have to work hard, but we have to be wise, sensitive as well. If we reach too far, sometimes reaching too far, being too greedy, we lose everything which we have. So by understanding that, we can learn how to be innovative, how to be sensible, how to be wise. And many, many Buddhists become very, very successful that way. Also, we understand, like, you know, in business, because people have to work so hard, because it's always tough in business, always was, always will be, sometimes to be successful we have to have other abilities which our competitors don't have. And one of those great abilities which we can develop as Buddhists is the ability just to take time out again. Just like, as I was saying, if you're having an argument with your wife, put your hand up and say, quiet time, please. If you're having some stress in your office, put up your own hand and say, let's have some quiet time. Which modern executives in the US have done. They have like time out rooms in most of the major corporations in the US. These are rooms in the headquarters where the mobile phones can't reach. I don't know how they do it. They put some electronic devices to cut out all mobile phone access. So once the executive goes in that room, they are free. The mobile phone, even if they take it with them, the signal can't reach them. And no secretary can go in there. No one can call them. It's a timeout room. And the reason why they have these and the reason why the executives use these things is because it's not just hard work which is important for success. Some people think it's just brute force. The same in meditation. It's just brute force. I'm going to sit, and I'm going to be successful in my meditation. I'm going to work, I'm going to be successful in business. No, that doesn't work. Sometimes you need to have efficiency. Efficiency in your relationship, efficiency in your own mind, efficiency in your business. And to be able to do that, you can understand as a few minutes of rest makes you see things more clearly. When you see things more clearly, you don't make so many mistakes in business. When you don't make so many mistakes in business, you're far more successful. Sometimes people ask, what does Ajahn Brahm know about this? You're a monk, you never started in business. Some years ago, I went to, in Western Australia, they were having a seminar on road transport in that state, and I was invited along to attend. And during the seminar there was one person did an interview with me on shipping. And so I gave him my advice on transport and shipping. That article was published all over the world. It made all the great shipping magazines. He titled it Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. And somebody came up to me, and actually he told me that one of his friends said, "That monk, he really knows what he's talking about." And I replied, "I don't know anything what I'm talking about. I don't know anything about shipping." But still, because you had basic principles, you could apply it to something you had no expertise in, and it was acknowledged as meaningful, accurate, helpful. It's amazing how powerful Buddhism can be. Just the basic principles apply across the board on how to have success. Even in the corporate boardroom, when you have to make decisions, Buddhist principles help. In the boardroom of the state government of Western Australia, I've been told this by several of the ministers in the government of Western Australia, whenever they're having an argument at cabinet, and I think the West Australian economy, they turn over about $17 billion every year. That's their budget. So it's quite a big company. Whenever they have an argument, the Premier, Dr. Gallup, who's read my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, he says, "Stop it! We should be more Buddhist about this." As he does. Because what he realizes is that if you're arguing, no one's listening to each other, and you're not going to make wise decisions. So he's actually using Buddhist principles to have success in government as a politician. And one of the sayings in that book, which he reminded me of, he said, "The saying I like the most, which I'm using every day in my political life," he said, "is don't allow other people to control your happiness. I'm not allowing the media to control my happiness anymore." Because sometimes being a top politician in Western countries, any top politician always gets a very, very hard press. People always criticize him for not doing enough. Small faults are acknowledged in the press. All the good things which they've done never get mentioned. So very often the press was giving him such a hard time, and he said, "I'm not going to allow that to make me unhappy anymore, thanks to my book." So you see, these principles can actually, even in big business, in politics, can actually help you, instead of wasting time getting upset what other people say about you, instead of wasting time arguing, instead of losing great opportunities, you can actually be more efficient, more clear, and thereby give yourself a greater chance for success. Also, that we have such Buddhist principles as compassion and kindness, and that's also important in business, because if you have a little bit of compassion and care for others, again, you have your networks, people look after you, you look after them. As you know, so many deals are done on trust. On one of the first global conferences we had, there was a friend, Colin Ash, because I've known him for many years. He was on the committee of the Buddhist Society of London, and when I was visiting my mother, I went to give many talks down there. He's also on the board of the Bank of England. He's a professor of economics, at that time anyway, at Reading University. So when he came to the global conference, he was an old friend I met, and he gave a talk on the economic benefits of monks and nuns. It's a fascinating subject. Because he said, as an economist, you should understand that one of the ways to have economic growth in any community is to have an increase in population, lots of children. That's important, because the children need schooling, they need homes, they need sort of resources like refrigerators, white goods or whatever. That keeps the economy turning over. He said, monks and nuns are hopeless for that part of the economy. But he said the positive side of monks and nuns to a economy, which is actually the positive side of Buddhism or religion to any economy, how to have success. He said one of the biggest problems in any economy, what really cuts back the GDP, is what's called transaction costs. And he made it very simple. What transaction costs are, is if you're buying a product, you've got to know that that product is actually is according to the specifications. A lot of the time it's not. The company sells you that product, but doesn't live up to what they say it can do. And because of that, there's a lot of mistrust. A lot of things get sent back. And that's called the first part of transaction costs, when the seller does not actually tell the truth about their product. And number two is the customer sometimes doesn't pay, or doesn't pay on time, or pays many, many weeks, months afterwards. That's the other part of the transaction cost, when the customer's not honest. And as you know, that so much problems in business come from having faulty products or by not getting the money from your customers. And because of that, you have to factor in a lot of money which gets lost in transaction costs. And he was saying, if there was more honesty in the world of business, those transaction costs would go down and the GDP would go up. Everybody would do better. And he said, the one positive thing about monks and nuns or religions in the world is it promotes greater honesty, payment on time, trust, keeping your promises. And he said, because of that, countries should be more successful, the more honest they are. And I think you can understand that in business, just how many times people have cheated you. They said they're going to give this product at a certain time and they don't. You have to ring them up, you have to chase them up, and part of your staff wastes a lot of time just worrying about getting that product on time. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you had a company and they say, we're going to deliver it on Tuesday, and every time they did deliver it on Tuesday at that time? Or if you were currying a bank draft to Perth and you knew it would actually get there at that time, because apparently they couriered the bank draft on my airfare and it still hasn't arrived, apparently. Because sometimes the companies, they say one thing and they do another. They don't tell the truth. And you have to wait for things. And that can ruin your business. Stop. So if there's more honesty in this world, there's more success in business. Things go much better in life. So what I'm saying here is actually to get success in life, we have to build up those relationships of trust, honesty, sensitivity to one another, and then our transaction costs go down. We don't waste so many of our resources. Things run more smoothly. Honesty. And you can't tell other people to be honest. You can only tell yourself to be honest. Start with you first. And the more honest people we have in this world, the more trustworthy people we have in this world, the more success which we have in this world. And this is actually how we build success in our businesses. But even with the best will in the world, that sometimes you have a business idea and sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes bankruptcies happen. But you try your very best. So sometimes you do come across failure. But sometimes you wonder, is it really failure after all? You tried your best. How can that be failure? This monk once told me, it's a very good piece of advice for my life. He said, don't try to be enlightened. Don't try to get deep meditation. Just do your very best. And when you go to sleep at night and you look back on your day, if you really put maximum effort, you tried your very best, what more can you do? How can you ever say that's a failure? So he said, if things go right, you become a millionaire or you become enlightened as a monk, that's some karma. But you've done your very best. You've given the karma you have the most positive possibility of success by doing your very best. But don't get disappointed if it doesn't achieve enlightenment if you're a monk, or if you don't achieve being a millionaire if you're a businessman, or the paying off your house if you're just an ordinary working person. You've tried your very best. Well done. At least you'll have that inner success. Having done your very best, you'll be able to sleep well at night. And you'll be able to have much greater inner happiness, inner success, than some people who are just living on the edge because they know that their so-called wealth is built on bad conduct, sometimes illegal conduct, and they know that soon, one day, they're going to be caught. If they're not caught, they're worried every day that one day they'll be caught. I'm talking about, you know, people like the head of Tyco, or the people at Enron or wherever, and Arthur Anderson, people who take the easy way out, who don't keep their precepts, and eventually, if they don't actually get caught now, they're worried about being caught. And all of their wealth, their success, is of no use to them when they're in jail. So this is actually keeping that sense of morality in business. And then we do actually become successful. If we don't actually become successful, we try very hard. As one person once said, they gave this advice, whatever you do in life, make sure you have passion with what you do. You really enjoy what you do. Because if you enjoy what you do, it might be a business venture, it might be just being a nurse, whatever else, then you become successful because you really enjoy what you're doing. And if it's a business, which you, a venture, you're passionate about it, you give it everything you've got, even if it fails, you said you've had a wonderful time, a time of great enjoyment. So how can that be called a failure? So when you look at what the real meaning of success and failure in life, you give it everything you've got and you try to do your best. If it fails, it's only the world calls it failure, at least you've given it a try. You've given it a go. Even as a monk, sometimes I take big risks. Even as a monk, I live life on the edge. Because you never know. You make, you know, choices about building up monasteries, you never know whether it's going to be successful or not. In my life as a monk, many, many things we tried and we didn't know whether we were going to succeed or not. Even just 21 years ago, going to Australia and building a monastery, we didn't know whether I was going to succeed. And actually most people thought, you know, we're stupid going to that place. If you're going to go to a place, please go to Sydney where there's a big population. Why go to Perth of all places to build a monastery? But we went there. And it was very hard work. We kept on going. Many people thought we'd never make it, but we did, because we kept on going year after year after year after year. It was 21 years it took to build a monastery. It's a long time. It's not like, you know, okay, let's make a collection, we're going to build it this year. And we had to do it slowly, because at first no one trusted us. Even the Thai people, they came up to me afterwards and they say, when you two monks first came here, we didn't know who you were. We didn't know whether you were real monks or not. Why should we give money to you if you're just going to be here for 6 months and then go somewhere else? So for the first year, most of the people just looked at us, checked us out to see what our conduct was like. And when they saw just how well we practiced and how hard we worked, as monks, those first year was tough. Used to get up, was it 3 o'clock in the morning in those days? Actually, it was easy to get up at 3 o'clock, I'll tell you why later on. And you get up there and you try and do some meditation, and at first light you were working, mixing concrete, laying bricks, sawing wood, because there was no place to stay. We had to build. And you'd keep on working, sometimes, you know, you'd have your lunch. After lunch was finished, back working, no rest, until you couldn't see anymore. And because there was no place to wash, we'd take water from the dam, you've seen a picture of the dam up there earlier today, in buckets, and throw it over yourself. By that time, the wind was up, it was freezing. But you had to, because you were so dirty. And then you went to sleep. The first place I had to sleep was that door I mentioned in the book, with ribs on. That wasn't the problem. The problem was, in about midnight, you'd always get this strong wind would come from the east and it would wake you up. So you only had about 2 or 3 hours sleep. So it didn't matter about, you're already awake at midnight, so it didn't matter about getting up at 3 o'clock. And you work like that, day in, day out. It was tough, and no one was helping us. But because people saw just how committed we were and how hard we worked, after 1 year, people really got behind us and they started donating. And that's because of our passion for a monastery. Doesn't matter how long it takes, I'm going to build this, I'm going to do this. That's why it worked. Some years later, we decided to start a nun's monastery. That was really on the edge, because that hadn't been done before. Like a Theravada nun's monastery, just for women, for no one else. And of course people thought, no, that's not going to work either. But it inspired people, we got donations, and we got a good nun to lead it. And that's been very successful. Now you start a retreat center, I start all these other things which you get on doing. Is it going to be successful or not? Sometimes you just make those decisions. Let's go for it, out of faith. This is a good thing, a retreat center or whatever. And because you have faith, it works. And you're going to give it everything you've got, you don't matter how long it takes. That way, you'll always find success. In Buddhism, we call it the four Iddhipadas, the road to success. You have your goal, and you apply your mind, you give it energy, but always you investigate as well to find better ways of doing it. That in Buddhism is called the road to success. In building monasteries, in building companies, in having a relationship, whatever you do in life. Hard work, keeping on going, never giving up on your goal. Which is why earlier, when someone had said, do I believe in divorce? I don't believe in giving up on a good cause. Just keep on going, 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 going. That's what I've done for 21 years. Just keep on going, 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 going. And eventually, because of your commitment, you usually achieve your goal. As it says in the Chinese Art of War, it said, even if your enemy's got fewer troops than you have, even if they haven't got as many armaments as you have, if they are more committed than you are, you're going to lose. It's that degree of commitment which you have. You say, I'm going to keep on doing this, I'm going to keep on going, I'm not going to give up. That's why you eventually win. So, that is what you hear in motivational psychology courses. You've heard it here for 60 ringgit, not 6,000. How to have success in your life. Don't get divorced. This is a woman I've married. I'm going to work this out. We're going to stick together. Because there's nowhere else to go. You know that story? I'll finish off with that story. Isn't it wonderful? Apparently you were short of rain. In the last couple of days, the rain has come here. So all of your brown lawns, the dry grass, is becoming wet. Why is that? Because the heavenly beings are so happy with all of you coming to this seminar. It's success! So if you keep on going and you work hard, you'll always be successful in life. That's certainly the story of my life. I consider myself a successful monk. It's not easy. It's been hard work. And because of that, you build up this wonderful relationship with so many people all over the world. How do I get that relationship? Why do so many people come here and got so many friends in KL? It's because you look at each person and everyone is important. When I was signing these books at the tea break, somebody remarked just how neat my handwriting was. And I said, because I care for every person who comes up here. I care enough. You've come up here, you've bought my book. I'm going to write a neat signature for you. Because I care. That's why I'm successful. If you have that same degree of care with every one of your customers, because those were my customers, if you care that much on your customers, you will have as many customers as I have. And you can see what the road to success is. So I think I've said enough about that. Now let's open it up for Q&A. So that's how to be successful in life, in your business. I already said about in your family, in your monastery, whatever else you're doing. So Q&A now. Yeah, we've got the first question already.
Ajahn Brahm, could you please elaborate a little bit on right livelihood? What if, for example, for some reasons, somebody is a butcher, and then he finds Buddhism, and he realizes that it is not a favorable livelihood?
Okay, you're asking about right livelihood, especially if you're a butcher. This actually was a story from Ajahn Chah's time. There was one of his disciples, actually, that he went to see Ajahn Chah to ask for a lottery number, because Ajahn Chah had psychic powers. He was very poor, But as soon as he actually came to ask Ajahn Chah, even before he'd opened his mouth, Ajahn Chah said, "You've come for a lottery number, haven't you?" He read his mind. And that so impressed this villager that he became a disciple, and a very good disciple of Ajahn Chah. His name was Por Am. And anyway, that he decided he wanted to take the five precepts. But he said, "How can I take the five precepts? Because I have to catch fish for my family. This is like a subsistence economy. I grow rice in the wet season, and I catch fish. That's all we can live on because there's hardly any vegetables. So this is your question, how do you make right livelihood if you're a fisherman or you're a butcher?" And one of the wonderful things about Buddhism, it's practical. What Ajahn Chah said, he said, "Okay, carry on catching fish, but only enough to feed your family, not enough to sell." In the meantime, Ajahn Chah said, this is only a temporary measure. In the meantime, Ajahn Chah said, "I'm going to teach you all I know about herbal medicine." Because the forest monks had to know herbal medicine. It was part of what you learnt in those days because there were no doctors. You were in the jungles. If you didn't know how to cure snake bite, you would die. There were no mobile phones to ring some ambulance. So all those old monks, they were this great repositories of knowledge about the herbs which grew in the jungles. And Ajahn Chah was very knowledgeable. So he taught this man everything he knew about herbal medicine until the point came this farmer did not need to catch fish anymore. He made his livelihood from medicine. He became known in the area. His medicine for typhoid was well known. And the hospital, because some of our monks got typhoid, he said, "Why are you coming here? Go and see this man. His medicine is much better than the chemical medicines." So he became very well known, and he was the local medicine man, and he didn't need to catch fish anymore. Now that was actually how you deal with getting right livelihood. If you are a butcher and you're having to feed your family, you can't tell that person, "Stop it right away," because that would be unfair for the family. You have to say, "That is wrong livelihood. See if you can actually learn another profession. Change. But do it gently, do it slowly, but make that your goal to get another profession." I don't know if I told you this story, but during the Second Gulf War, one of our members, a close member, a past president of our society, he also, because he's a very kind man, he volunteers for a group called the Samaritans, which offers counseling by phone to anyone who's suicidal. It's a well-known number. If anybody in the community is about to commit suicide, they know this number as a last desperate attempt to get some advice. And he was, one year, he was the president of the Samaritans in Australia. They only take that role for 1 year, but most of the time, once a week, he spends all night on the telephone answering people who are so depressed they were suicidal. During the Second Iraq War, he got a telephone call from an English-sounding man who announced to him that he was the inventor of the cluster bomb, who had migrated to Perth. He'd just seen on the TV what his invention had done in Iraq. You can imagine the suffering that man felt when he saw just the children whose bodies have been torn apart by his bomb, by the mothers who'd lost their children, the wives who'd lost their husbands because of his invention. His suffering, I can't imagine what it must have been like. I don't know if he managed to talk him out of committing suicide, but that must have been one of the toughest assignments, to try and talk the inventor of a cluster bomb out of killing himself, when he saw the effect of his invention on the television. That's why the Buddha said, dwelling or dealing in alms is bad karma. The pain, the suffering, the tears you cause is huge. When you see that, you can't live with yourself. So that's why the alms trade is called wrong karma. Being a butcher or a fisherman is bad karma.
Anything which kills, which harms, is called bad karma. As Bhikkhu Hai once told me, he met once the executioner of Malaysia, the one who actually hangs people. And he said when he came into the room, everybody just felt so uncomfortable around this guy. They were scared. This aura, you know, what you feel around him, which is so negative, as you can imagine, from someone who is paid to be the executioner in the jails of Malaysia. That's why it's bad karma. So you can understand that what the Buddha said is not theory. You can actually know that for yourself. You can feel it. So it's much better to take a cut in salary and get an increase in karma, good karma, than actually do bad karma by having bad livelihood. You'll feel much better about yourself afterwards. Hope that answers the question. Now you go next question, yeah?
Thanks. My question is, through the past hour, right, Ajahn Mamri have been saying that cooperation is vital to guarantee a healthy living relationship. Well, consider these two scenarios. A is an individualistic leader in the sense that he unites all the members of his group by brute force, and through this, he is able to make each and every member cooperate to achieve a specific motive. And B, however, is a group leader in the sense that he works together with the group to work towards a specific objective. But however, B uses a very friendly and direct approach. However, B's leadership is somehow questionable as he uses a very friendly way to approach his colleagues. His leadership, his rank would be almost the same as there is no brute force involved. So in your opinion, Ajahn Brahm, which of these two leaders, A and B, is best in accordance to Buddhism? Thanks.
Okay, not just in Buddhism, the best leader is always the one who encourages people rather than uses brute force. Because you find out what happens if you use brute force. Sooner or later, people rebel. You use brute force. After a while, people don't do anything. There's an old Buddhist story, which many of you may remember, the story of Nandivisala, the ox. It's one of my favorite Buddhist Jataka tales. In this story, I hope you're sitting comfortably, once upon a time, there was an ox named Nandivisala. This was the time before Walt Disney, but even in those days, the animals could speak. And one day, Nandivisala, the ox, went up to his master, who was a very poor farmer, saying, "Master, you're getting very old. It's about time you retired from pulling the plow. And me too, I'm getting old too. I want to retire." And the master said, "Nandivisala, you've been such a good ox to me, but how can I retire? I don't earn that much. I got a big family. I haven't got enough money to retire. I'll probably have to work till I die." And Nandivisala said, "Yes, I know that, but I've got a plan. I am very strong. I am probably the strongest ox in the whole of India. Now there's a man in the village who's very wealthy, who likes to gamble. Why don't you go up to him and say that my ox, Nandivisala, is so strong he can pull 100 carts full of stones all tied together?" And his master said, "Look, Nandivisala, you're a very strong ox, but you can't do that." "Yeah, I can." "You sure?" "Yeah, now you go and make a bet, $100,000 US. If you're going to do it full on. My ox can pull 100 carts. He won't believe me. He won't believe I can do this. Just like you didn't believe me, but I can. And then we can make $100,000. That means you can retire and so can I. All I ask you is to get some good grass every day, that's all. You can keep the money, I just want some grass." So the man said, "Okay, we'll do it." So he went to the rich man in the village and say, I wager you that my ox, the strongest ox in the whole of India, can pull 100 carts full of stones all tied together. He said, ah, no ox can do that. My ox can. I bet you $100,000 US it can. Okay, you're on. Because the rich man would always want to get more money. So because it needed 100 carts, and the farmer never had those many carts, they had to get everyone in the village to join together, to borrow a cart from here, a cart from there, to tie them together, to fill them all with rocks. And when they'd filled them all with rocks and tied them all together, they tied Nandi Visala, this big ox, at the front cart. And with all the whole village watching, especially the rich man, Nandi Visala's master got onto the first cart and said, okay, pull these carts, you stupid ox. And at that, the ox stood absolutely still. Come on, pull! He shouted at his ox. And the ox never moved. If you don't pull these carts, I will whip you, said the master, picking up the whip. The ox didn't move. And the master whipped him. Still he wouldn't move. And people started laughing. What a stupid farmer that was. No ox can pull those carts. People started laughing. And the master started crying when he realized he'd lost $100,000 US. He couldn't afford that. He would have to sell all his land and he'd still be in debt. He was ruined. He went to a tree and wept. How stupid and foolish he was to have believed his ox. And as he was crying, absolutely ruined, he felt something wet and moist in his ears. He looked around and he found that that was the nose of his ox, Nandi Visala. And Nandi Visala said, why are you crying, master? Because of you, you stupid ox. You said you could pull those carts and you can't. But I can, said the ox. No, you can't. Yes, I can. Well, why didn't you? And the ox said, because, master, you called me stupid. And then you shouted at me. And then you even hit me. Now, I'll never do anything if you're that mean to me. It's a bit late now, said the master. I've lost my money. He said, no, you haven't. I've got plan B. Now, said the ox, those carts, they're still there. They haven't unloaded them yet. You go to that rich man and you say, I bet you that my ox, Nandi Visala, the strongest ox in the whole of India, can pull 100 carts made of stones. And this time I bet you 200,000 US. I'm sure the rich man would accept that. So he went back. He had nothing to lose. So he went back to the rich man and said, my ox, that was only a rehearsal. This is the real thing. I bet you $200,000 my ox can pull all those carts. Okay, you're on, he said. And this time all the villagers were thinking, what a stupid man. Now he's going to lose another $200,000. So they tied Nandi Visala to the front cart. And the master went up to the front cart, stood on it, and this time he said, dear ox, kind ox, oh faithful ox, if it's not too much trouble for you, would you mind, if it's not too much trouble, if it's too much, don't mind, would you mind just pulling these carts just a little bit, just for me? And that ox strained all his muscles. You can see the veins standing out from his side. He pulled harder than any ox in the whole of India had ever pulled before. And what happened? Nothing. That was really heavy. So the master said, look, stop it, never mind. You've been such a good ox to me. If we can't do this, I don't want to kill you. Let go. And those few kind words, that ox strained again. This time there was sweat coming out from his brow. The veins were even more protruding. And this time he pulled harder than any ox had ever pulled in the whole history, not just of India, of the whole earth, Malaysia included. And he pulled so hard. And what happened? Nothing, yeah. The master said, look, stop it. I know you're kind, ox, but I don't want you to hurt yourself. I'd rather be poor and have you as a friend than have you die. let it go, kind ox. Now those real, selfless, compassionate words, the ox strained again. This time, he pulled, not only the veins were coming out of his body, the sweat was pouring down, the eyes were bulging out as well. And he pulled harder than any ox had ever pulled in the whole history of the universe. Even in Mars, no ox had ever pulled so hard. And you wouldn't believe just the effort this ox pulled. And first of all, you just heard a little creak. Something moved. And from that first little creak, there was another creak, a little bit louder, as another wheel started to move. As you know by the laws of friction, once things start to move, the friction gets less. The carts were moving. It was a miracle. And all the people were cheering, which made the ox pull harder. And after a short while, everyone was cheering and laughing as the ox had pulled these 100 carts. Everyone was cheering. The master was crying with joy. The rich man was crying also. He'd lost $100,000. No, because he owed him $100,000 before. He got $200,000, so it's $100,000 up. Pay attention. So in the end, the master could retire, and the ox spent the last years of his life just eating grass, having a wonderful time, never needed to pull the plough again. The story of Nandi Visala, the ox. And the moral of that story was, if you treat someone with kindness, they will work much harder for you. So, if you want that nice new dress from your husband, dear husband, kind husband, if it's not too much, if it's too much trouble, don't worry about it. That's how you get your dress. Dear members of BGF, if it's not too much trouble about my retreat centre, if it's too much trouble, don't worry about it. That's how you get things done in the world. So in a company, you know, that was actually the story told by the Buddha. And I found that works in life. You get much more help when you're kind to others than when you're demanding and forceful. People want to help. And they really just pour harder than they should be able to pour if it's out of kindness. I don't know what you've been doing for the tsunami. Last Sunday in Perth, we had a fundraiser for the tsunami, and I couldn't believe just how hard people pulled together for that. I was just complete, more exhausted than I'd been for many years. So was everybody else. But we raised so much, and people were so happy, simply because we were all working together for a good cause, kindness. Never needed to order anyone around. Just, if it's not too much trouble, please come and give a hand. And they all did. That's how I've worked in my life, and it's been successful. Any one of you who've ever been to my monastery in Perth, you spent time there, I would guarantee that you'll never have heard me shout at my monks, not once. I don't think I've ever shouted at my monks. I just encourage them. And that's why there's so many good monks at my monastery. You get much more out of them with kindness. So that's the answer to your question. My experience is the best leader is one who leads, encouraging with kindness than with force. Next question. Yeah. Oh, which one is it?
Ajahn Brahm, we know the relationship is very important, but we also know the one hand we cannot clap. So if you have do your very best to build a relationship with others, and yet it was not working. In this situation, how should we proceed? Because as a lay person, we know that we have our own limit as well.
I think, are you asking if you're starting a relationship but it's not working?
Yeah, you have tried to do your best to improve the relationship or whatever, but it's not working, and you by yourself have your limit, and you cannot proceed anymore. How should we go at this junction?
Well, sometimes you say, I can't proceed anymore. Sometimes I think that's giving up too easily. Keep on going. No matter how long it takes, keep on going. Keep on going. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, keep on going. Don't give up too easily. If it's not working yet, keep on going. Because patience is one of those great virtues of Buddhism. And was it that story? There was a Japanese monk. Apparently he killed someone out of anger. And for his penance, he saw in this road, there was a big rock had fallen along the road. He decided actually to try and make a thoroughfare through it. And so he managed to beg a hammer and a chisel. And he started chipping away at this big stone rock. Every day he would work hard. And I think after a year he'd only got a foot through the rock. It was so solid. But when one of the shoguns saw this, he said, this guy's crazy. How can you put a hole through this rock? It will take him 100 years. But he never gave up. He kept on trying. And the shogun was so impressed because he was working so hard. He sent some of his workers to help. And he got all this help, and eventually they got through. I think that road is still there with a sign on actually how they built this tunnel through this huge rock. Just one person, one monk, didn't care how long it took. He was going to carry on. And when you have that degree of persistence, it's amazing what forces, either your friends, actually come to help you when you realize how committed you are. So, actually, maybe I'm idealistic here, but I don't think any relationship should be thrown away that easily. I don't think people should be thrown away that easily. I think we give up too easily, I think, is the message here. So maybe try again. Doesn't matter how long it takes, keep on going. Because if you can't make that relationship work, maybe you have to be with that person in your next life. If you don't make it work this life, maybe the next life you'll be married to that person. So, it's unfinished business, so finish it off as soon as you can. And if it really is beyond you and it's driving you crazy, okay. But make it as a last resort. Don't give up too easily in life. Next question.
Hello, Acham Brahm. Thank you once again for coming to Malaysia to share Dharma with us. I have got two questions, and that is, number one, what is an A-star student in the Dharma? Two, what is a successful business plan for the Buddhists?
Okay, what is an A-class student in Buddhism? I suppose the A-class one is one who is selfless, who never thinks of themselves as an A-class one, who doesn't actually judge themselves as A-class, B-class, or C-class. Someone who is just does as best they can, who is kind, who is generous, who never actually seeks for recognition in what they do. And sometimes they're the people who you don't see, the ones you don't see up on the stage, the people who work selflessly behind the scenes, because they don't really want to put themselves forward, they're just serving for the sake of serving. They're so selfless and kind. Sometimes the best enlightened beings are the ones you never actually see. There's one of these monks, his name was Ajahn Dun, passed away only recently. He was this great arahat who lived in the northeast of Thailand. No one knew about him. Only a few monks knew that he was fully enlightened. He was just this old monk who lived in the village, who would go on alms round every day. And the local villagers thought he was just an old monk, that's all. Because he was so selfless, so pure, that he just disappeared. Sometimes that's the A-class student in Buddhism. Someone who's let go of their ego so much. They're just there to serve. They never argue with you. They're always there to help. I think that's really the A-class student. And the selfless, or the best business plan for a Buddhist is actually to do your duties in the world. If you're a wife, do your duties to your husband.
If you're a mother, your duties to your children. You're a daughter, your duties to your parents. If you're a husband, do your duties to your wife. Be selfless in those duties. Do your duties to your parents, to your children. That's the business plan of life, doing duties. And if you really want to build up a business, remember your business, no matter what business it is all part of like the service to the community. If there wasn't like air companies, I would not be able to come to Malaysia to give a talk. So I've got gratitude. Actually, I flew Singapore Airlines. I've got gratitude to Singapore Airlines for flying me here to give Dhamma. So those people working, say, for the air companies, or, you know, for the people who produced the car which drove me here. Every job has got a place. It's an important part of our life. So don't think your job is unimportant. So your business plan is actually, whatever job you have, I'm going to do this to the best of my ability, to do my duty for my employer, to do my duty for my customers, to work hard so I can actually have enough funds to look after my family, to look after my children, to myself, and also to have enough funds to make punya, to make merit in this world, for my next life. So that's a successful business plan, for me anyway, to do your duties, to work hard, not just for the money, for serving your community, to serving your country, to serving your world, to make it a better world. And what money you make, share it out between your own, the four ways the Buddha said, for your own happiness, for your family, for investment, and also for charity, charitable works as well. And that's the best business plan made by the Buddha. Yeah?
Ajahn Brahm, just now you emphasized a lot on honesty for businesses, successful businesses, and also spiritual. In like doing business or when we are in the business, it's very difficult to be honest. I mean, I can't buy a pencil for $1 and tell everybody I bought it for $1 and then sell it for $1, isn't it? And sometimes our profit, like sometimes our customers or client asks, we can't tell them the truth. So how do we approach this?
Okay, in business, there's a lot of people say that, you know, you can't tell people the truth. Okay, don't tell them people the truth, but don't tell them lies. So don't tell them how much it costs. And it is true, I think there is some things which are understood in business, that you have to make some sort of profit. You don't tell your competitors where you're sourcing your materials. You don't tell your competitors your profit margins or the secrets of your business. But as long as you're fair, in other words, you know, you make a fair profit, you don't exploit people. And you may not actually tell the truth to your competitors or to business, but you don't tell lies either. I think that's very important in some things, especially when it's, you know, telling your customers about what your products can do. You know, if you sell, you know, a pencil, but it's only a piece of wood because you forgot to put the lead in the middle, then obviously, you know, your business is going to go bankrupt pretty quickly when you lose the trust of your clientele. So don't lie to your customers. And please don't lie to your staff either. Otherwise your staff will not want to work for you. Okay, maybe there are some areas in business which I don't know, because my business is the monk business where it works, to be honest. But in other businesses, okay, fair enough, it might not work. But at least try and lessen your dishonesty. So actually try and be more honest. If you can't be perfectly honest, at least be more honest. So we start from there, and then we can work upwards. But it reminds me of a story of one of the disciples in Sydney, that he had some big business, I think it was in catering or something. And, no, it's in some other business, not catering. But there was some people from Taiwan were sort of interested in some big contract. It was a multi-million dollar contract. And after many negotiations over the internet, they flew to Sydney. They had a deal ready. They negotiated the details of the deal. Both parties agreed and they were ready to sign. But the Taiwanese business people told my friend, he said, "We'll sign this evening in the bar. This evening you will buy us drinks and you will supply us with prostitutes." He said, that's our tradition. You pay, we enjoy, and then we will sign the contract. He said, "Look, I agree on the contract, but I don't agree on that part of the contract." He said, "I'm a Buddhist, and I keep my five precepts. I don't drink alcohol. I will not go to the bar with you. Also, I have a wife. I'm faithful to her. I will not go with any prostitutes." And the Taiwanese business people, apparently, you know, they got very upset with him and said, "Look, if you don't do this, there's no deal. It's either, you know, do our tradition or we won't sign." There's many, many millions of dollars were involved. He said, "Okay, I'm not going to sign." And the Taiwanese business people walked out. He'd lost the deal. I was very impressed with that business person. He'd rather keep the five precepts than actually make money for his company. However, the story never ended there. Because that evening, he got a telephone call. The Taiwanese were at the pub, at the bar, and they'd been talking, they said. "We've been thinking, it's much better to sign a deal with someone who's moral and virtuous. We're coming over straight away." They signed that deal at his house. He stood his ground on moral principles, and the business person realized, if you're going to do business with someone, isn't it better to do business with someone you can trust? If he doesn't cheat on his wife, he's not likely to cheat with us. So they signed that deal. He got the contract because he kept his precepts. And a beautiful story. Does it make sense with you? If you're doing a deal with someone, would you like to do a deal with someone who cheats on their wife, who goes and gets drunk? Is that a trustworthy business to deal with? Or would you rather sign a business deal with someone who's honest and virtuous, someone you can trust? I know who I would sign that business deal with. You're much more likely not to lose with honest people. So, who would sign a business deal with you? Many people, if you're honest.